Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5.
This disclaimer is a statement notifying listening audiences that any opinions expressed on our shows are not representative of Laguna Radio Inc., its management, or its board of directors.
Good evening and welcome to the Dr. Kim Sage Show. I am your host, Dr. Kim Sage, and you are listening to a show that explores our moods, our minds, our real lives, and everything to do with therapy and psychology, and really just our chronic stressors and our life's big and little traumas. And so tonight we are going to be talking about a topic that has been really trending and emerging really kind of everywhere. And I will say it's a topic that I do not know a lot about. Often I have guests and I sort of know the topic, and or I might act like I don't know anything and ask questions, but I usually know something or a lot, to be honest. But in this scenario, I really don't know very much. And so even though I did some research, I'm very excited to have a guest who does know a lot about this topic. So we're going to be talking about the clinical use of psychedelics and emerging trends, and with Dr. Edward Marginist. And remember that this show airs live every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on KX93.5. And you can also listen via podcast the next day. All right, so welcome, Dr. Marginist.
Thank you, Dr. Sage.
I'm so glad you're here to join me. Dr. Marginist is a Newport Beach psychologist who specializes in treating children, teens, and young adults with issues around depression, anxiety, ADHD, and academic issues. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, that is.
Awesome. Okay. So, but tonight we're going to take a hard, sharp turn.
Yes. This is a subject of intense interest in psychology that has absolutely no application with my current clinical population.
Yeah. Well, I do work with a lot of trauma. And so this is why I sort of asked you to come join me first
absolutely.
And foremost, because this topic is really emerging around treating trauma and more severe or difficult mental health issues. Okay. So let's just start out with, first of all, our disclaimer.
Yes.
Which is, I'm going to let you go ahead and say it.
So we are not encouraging the use of illegal drugs, and we are actively discouraging their use. And what we're seeing now is that there's a lot of research and a lot of claims about psychedelic drugs used in conjunction with psychotherapy to help with a variety of psychological conditions. And
okay, great. So what we're saying is we're not telling you to use drugs,
no.
But we're going to talk about drugs for the next hour. And we're going to talk about them in conjunction with using them to treat mental health issues, right? So when we say psychedelics, let's talk about specifically what we're going to be talking about and what that term means.
Okay, so when we're talking about psychedelics, we mean drugs like LSD, like psilocybin mushrooms, MDMA, sometimes called ecstasy, DMT, ketamine. So we're not talking about all illegal drugs, just this class of drugs. And those are the kinds of drugs where people talk about going on trips, and whether you think people should go on trips or not, or whether they should go on certain trips, that's peripheral to this discussion. This is what kind of clinical uses might these drugs have in treating a variety of psychopathology.
Okay, so let's just go through really quickly. I want you to add ayahuasca to this one.
Absolutely.
So just explain, I'm going to ask you and you go quickly. Okay, what is LSD?
It does occur in nature, and it is a fungus, I believe, called ergot that grows on wheat. And it was synthesized in a lab in the 40s and sort of accidentally so. And the gentleman, Dr. Hoffman, who discovered it, he accidentally got some of it on his arm. And then he went on the first sort of LSD trip.
The first real trip.
Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. So when we say
Psilocybin.
Psilocybin. Tell us about what that is.
So psilocybin is the active ingredient in certain mushrooms that people have used and found have trip qualities to them, and also possibly therapeutic qualities.
Okay, so it's mushrooms, basically, yes. Like as we might know them back in the day, shrooms.
Yes, right? It is shrooms, absolutely.
Okay, MDMA, what's that?
MDMA, ecstasy, it's a drug that actually was used originally clinically.
I do know that one,
to enhance empathy, and then it sort of became the rave and club drug. And all of these drugs, by the way, are Schedule One, and they're sort of making sort of permissions to use them in the research.
Okay.
So that's MDMA.
Okay. Now that one, and I want to talk about all this before we go on too, is how people can cut these drugs with other things. So we're talking about the pure forms when we go into these conversations also.
Yes. Yes. And that's, the concern with, particularly, everything except for the mushrooms is that, people can cut them with anything else. So if you go and your local drug dealer says, you can trust me, this is MDMA, it may be cut with something else, and it may not give you the effect that you want.
Right.
So that's, in terms of other reasons, not to encourage the use.
Right. But that's important, isn't it? We're talking about the sort of the psychiatrist prescribed level of medication. Okay.
Yes.
So let's just finish up with DMT, ketamine, and ayahuasca.
Yes.
What are those?
And DMT and ayahuasca are sort of the same drug. Ayahuasca is two plants in the forest. One actually has the DMT, and then one of the other plants suppresses the stomach from digesting it. It's an MAOI. And so what that does is it makes it so that your body can actually absorb the DMT.
Okay.
And then ketamine is a drug that is currently used in anesthesia. So it does have uses, but anybody who uses ketamine now, at least in the usual sense, they're asleep. So whatever trip they went on, they didn't really experience it.
Except now they're using it with depression and things like that, right? So we are changing our uses, right? Okay, so let's just talk about why psychedelics and why this is happening and emerging. What are we finding out about psychedelics?
Well, why now is an interesting question because, and I guess the history of it is that, you know, when Sandoz Chemical started selling LSD, they gave it to psychiatrists. People were experimenting with it. They had very exciting experiments where they decided to have a bunch of graduate students come together, or professors who were working on certain problems. They said, come together every couple of days, we'll all do LSD together. And out of that came publications and patents and people moving ahead on things. After Richard Nixon, also from here in Orange County, when he became president, he declared war on drugs, and he made it was sweeping legislation that made these psychedelics illegal and Schedule One. So it's not just that they were illegal; it's hard to do research on them because the burden for being able to say, "Hey, we're researchers, and we'd like to." I'd like a couple of pints of this and let's do some research. The burden for that became extremely, extremely high. So there was this whole period, in the 70s and then the 80s of, just say no, that these drugs were not being able to be tested and had research done upon them for a very long time. But the advent of some of these getting onto the street, I suppose, people having maybe more openness toward natural remedies, and the advent of fMRI and being able to do brain imaging and showing that maybe there's some legitimacy to these drugs, maybe they can sort of affect things and help. All of that brought us to the era where we are now, where there's really a lot of discussion about not only are these drugs possibly effective, but a lot of publications that are suggesting that they are.
Yeah, I mean, I went to do some research, as I said to you before the show. I was amazed at we're going to get to that later in the show, but really very different degrees of use with cancer patients and veterans and victims of sexual trauma. So a lot out there. So why, let's talk about trauma. This is what we're doing that tonight, right? So what is it that psychedelics can help with regard to trauma and why?
Okay, so I want to lay a little bit of groundwork first by talking about just exactly that. So If we say, okay, here is the brain, and the brain, there's kind of the analogy of like a computer, and there's all these different parts and they all do different things. And if the computer breaks, though, then that part of the computer is broken. No video card, no USB part, however small or big, you're not getting that use anymore. So if you imagine that that's kind of like having a stroke, in the computer's case, the computer is not going to work. But in the case of a person with a stroke, they can start to regain use of a limb, start to regain cognitive capacity over time because of this thing called neuroplasticity, which says that if the brain has all of these connections, all of this wiring that happens, if there's a part that's damaged, other parts can kind of pick up the slack and new wiring can happen. It's plastic. So if that's true of a stroke patient and, you know, brain changes underlying an ability to, then the brain can compensate, then what might that mean to a person with a traumatized brain? But before all of this interest in psychedelics, the term neuroplasticity was something that we were hearing a lot about in terms of meditation. Right. And so in, you know, 2000, some researchers who were doing, working with the Dalai Lama and some of his followers found that their meditation led to changes in brain activity and also possibly even brain structures. And so these were parts of the brain that were associated with qualities such as attention, anxiety, depression, fear, anger, and the body's ability to heal itself.
Okay, hold on one sec.
Yes.
Okay, so if you're just tuning in, yes, we are talking about the use of psychedelics treating trauma. And our guest, yes, Dr. Marginis, was just explaining, yes, that as a part of the discovery of mindfulness meditations, yes, they learned that the brain has ability to sort of rewire itself in some, yes, ways, right? And you were relating, yes, that back to a stroke and how same thing, you can have certain parts of the brain die, but other parts, yeah, can begin to take over and compensate and things like that. Yes. So tell us how all of that ties into psychedelics and trauma again.
So within trauma, they found that there are brain changes, so kind of like in the case of a stroke, or kind of even in a positive sense, if somebody practices something a lot, there start to be brain changes. You know, they play the violin for 10,000 hours. So
we can see that on, yes, fMRI, right?
We can see it on fMRIs. Okay. So the traumatized brain is affected in three distinct areas. The prefrontal cortex, which is right at the front of the brain, that's the thinking center, thinking, planning, personality. The anterior cingulate cortex, which is right behind the prefrontal cortex, which is the emotion regulation center, which becomes diminished. And the amygdala, which is the fear center, which is the I'm really scared, and how to modulate that. So the traumatized brain shows that there's less activity in the thinking and emotional regulation, and there's more activity in the fear center.
Okay, so why is that? Tell us why.
Why that is theorized to be that if you are, and this is just conjecture, but if you're an individual that has undergone some trauma, that this would be an adaptive change for you. You should, if you're in a scary environment and there's horrible stuff happening, your fear should be higher up, and maybe this sort of deep thoughts that you could have in a safer environment shouldn't be happening.
So it's like a fight or, yeah, flight when you're in the middle of trauma, you're the freezing, you're, you know, that sort of all of that's happening to save your, yes, life in some way.
Yes.
The brain's functioning differently.
That fight or flight is, that's very aroused all the time. So
after trauma. Right.
And one of the problems is that, that trauma is so, it's such a prominent part in somebody's life that it can be triggered. So the veteran who comes back from the war and lives near Disneyland and the fireworks go off, they know literally that's not bombs or artillery, but they get that same fear response, and it's absolutely terrifying for them. So now there's this pathway that they've got that's deeply ingrained, because a profound experience like being in the war it's not something the brain wants to forget, but now they're on guard all of the time, and it disrupts their life and they suffer. And we know about veterans, more veterans are dying of suicide than are dying in combat.
Right.
So that's not a small problem by any means. And as somebody who is, this was a rape survivor had said, it's not the trauma itself, it's the fact that I have to keep reliving it.
Right.
Because it's not that it's in the past for them. In some form, it's just with them all the time. And that makes functioning and being a productive and happy individual very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's like I love, you know, EMDR. And the whole idea behind that is that you have a traumatic experience or memory that is unprocessed. It's sort of just still in the brain. So it didn't get filed away in a place. It's just always there.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically what we're talking about. So that makes sense for someone who's like, they really are living in the trauma. And it is really hard to treat when you're in that heightened state all the time and the chaos it brings into your life.
It is extremely difficult to treat. And one reason that might make it that difficult is that there's a phrase, there's no such thing as a knot in psychotherapy, N-O-T. So it's the, you know, don't think of a pink elephant, and you know, then everybody's thinking of a pink elephant. So it's kind of hard to undo those kinds of pathways, at least in the normal sense, with our normal brains. So then when you look at things like meditation, where somebody's able to get more control over their brain and selectively activate areas so that they can have a more productive outlook, that takes a lot of practice. I bring up meditation because psychedelic drugs are not for everyone. And for folks that are prone to a schizophrenic diagnosis or living with schizophrenia, psychedelic drugs, which sort of loosen up and make notions of reality a little more malleable, it's not for them. And it can cause them to have episodes.
Yeah, that's the part that I said to you before that worries me a little bit, right? Because if now marijuana can actually create schizophrenia, which is so crazy to me, being a child of the 70s and 80s, but the drugs have changed. And so, you know, if that could create an onset for something like schizophrenia, I think it's really important that we're really assessing if people are going to be doing this, who is a good candidate and who is not.
Yes, that's absolutely, absolutely important. And it's interesting you mentioned marijuana, because marijuana is thought of as like maybe a light psychedelic too. So that kind of makes sense why that might be causing problems with folks living with schizophrenia. So our belief, though, and what we know from the research is that psychedelic drugs delivered in low doses, which is part of the protocols that people are doing with psychedelic drugs in the lab.
So when you say low dose, like, so what is that compared to like a regular dose that someone might take on the street?
So there is one...
Or microdosing. Let's talk about what that is.
What microdosing is that if somebody were to take the amount of LSD that would be typical for going on a trip, a microdose would be between 1/8 to 1/10 as much.
Okay.
And there's actually a protocol for microdosing that says you do that once every 3 days. And the microdoses are sometimes described as subclinical, meaning, or not subclinical, but you're not able to actually feel them, or you're only able to feel them in an extremely subtle kind of way. So it's only just kind of brought up to being able to feel it in a light way. So it's not really approximating a drug trip or a recreational experience if you're taking that little of it.
But when you're talking about all these drugs, are all of them in a microdose portion or only certain ones? So like if you're taking ecstasy with a therapist I was reading about, I'm assuming you're taking a bigger dose for that.
You could be, but there's also a research protocol for MDMA that you take a lower dose over maybe three different time periods.
And you said like every 3 days. So for how long would you be doing something like, let's say,
for the either the 10 times or the 8 times that you would take it?
Oh, so you take a whole dose over the course of,
it's just divided up. And then, but because this is done in a research sense, everybody's trying different amounts and different amounts of therapy, and then just reporting on did that work or not. And so that's going to be something to figure out, because you not only have all of this different kind of psychopathology, whether it's trauma, depression, anxiety, ADHD, and even on the outside end, I've seen that people are doing research for eating disorders and psychedelics. But so it's not only all of the different psychopathology, but it's all of the different psychedelic drugs that could be used. So,
and what role is a therapist playing? You said therapy. So, yes. I mean, are these all being used in conjunction with therapists or psychiatrists? How what do the protocols and the research look like, generally speaking?
The research can definitely vary, and it can vary all the way from simply administering in the most, I don't know how you describe this sense, but just taking the drug in a sort of usual dose and taking it one time and then reporting on it. That was reflective of a research finding some years ago, the one you were talking about with cancer patients, where it was let's give them psilocybin, right? These are cancer patients who were terminal, and they took psilocybin mushrooms, and something like half of them reported that that experience was in the top five experiences of their entire life.
Oh my gosh.
Which is, as far as a commercial for this stuff goes, it's right. Kind of hard to get better than that.
Right.
But they said, more importantly, that it helped them cope with facing mortality. That's one aspect of the research that's interesting here, is that if you're going to try a new drug or a new class of drugs on human beings, you start with human beings who are in the most severe cases. You know, either they're terminal, or in the case of treatment-resistant depression, and those folks who are, you know, obviously prone to committing suicide. There was a study done where they said they gave them psilocybin mushrooms, and I believe it was psilocybin mushrooms, either that or MDMA. And after a couple of months, 47% of them were subclinical for depression.
Wow.
So it wasn't even that the depression just, hey, that got a little better. They actually just didn't have the depression when nothing else worked.
That's
and
crazy.
It's those kinds of findings that make me think, as a therapist, people are going to be asking about this.
Right, and which is why we're talking about
yes.
it. Exactly.
And so we need to understand it and educate ourselves and be familiar with it.
I agree. That's why I'm so glad you're here.
Yes.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Dr. Edward Marginis, and he is a psychologist in Newport Beach. But we are actually talking about the specialty of using psychedelics in treating trauma and other mental health issues. So we were just talking about sort of the brain and trauma. What are these drugs doing to the brain, or that are affecting depression, trauma, things like that? What's
yes.
happening?
So what's happening is that if you look at an fMRI scan and you look at a brain and you tell people, you know, think of an apple or think of an orange or think of something happy or think of something traumatic, different parts of the brain will light up. And so we know that. So now if we do, you know, let's say we've got the fMRI machine and we're all excited about it. Now we say, hey, I wonder if the brains of people who are living with severe depression look anything like folks that are, or just if they look different than folks who are typical no depression diagnosis. And then you start to say, hey, we're noticing these differences in these people's brains. Then you can start to correlate function and structure with a person's psychopathology or underlying condition. And that goes for things that are much more broad than depression. There was even the study, I believe it was at UCI, about the guy was studying, psychopaths, which we would say colloquially. And he looked at their brains, and their brains looked different. And then he scanned himself and found that he was in the group.
Similar. Whoops.
So if we can correlate structure and function and say, hey, this part of the brain probably does this and this part of the brain probably does that. And we can say, now we're looking at folks that have a diagnosis, right? So here's a big sample of people and they all have the same diagnosis, and maybe their brains look a certain way. Then we can, then we have more control going in terms of what does it mean when this brain scan says this. But the thing that's compelling about psychedelics and the evidence in fMRIs is that you start to see a lot of the brain's areas that had not been talking to each other before. You know, if this area lights up and this area lights up when you think of something, when that happens, when you have a person who is taken a dose of psychedelics and then you put them in the fMRI machine, you start to see a lot of parts of the brain that were not talking together are now talking together. Wow. And so that underlies this idea that new neural pathways are being created.
So you're saying like the actual drug, taking the drug is changing the neural pathways.
It's changing the neural pathways. It's opening up the possibility of new, more productive neural pathways to be built. So if we put that knowledge together with the idea of traumatized brain looks different, and then we say, now we give that person some dose of psychedelic drugs, either what is happening is those entrenched bad pathways that are created in that person's mind, either those are being lessened in terms of the power of those connections, or new connections are being created, or the physical properties of the brain could possibly also be changed. So if, you know, the part, if you have a you know, if the amygdala, if it's bigger and that means that there's more fear, maybe it shrinks down. Okay. Now that the physical changes part, that's, we don't know that much. That's a more bold statement, but at least we can start to say, all right, if these different areas are lighting up that weren't lighting up before, then maybe there's a new conversation that's happening in the brain. And maybe that new conversation is the thing that is underlying the headlines and bottom lines that we've been reading about in the literature.
Okay, so we're talking about how psychedelics can be used to treat trauma in the brain. And what I'm wondering is, so in EMDR, right, we talk about how the brain heals itself. Mm-hmm. So that's eye movement, desensitization, reprocessing, for those of you who don't know, which is an amazing therapy. But we're saying to people, you're healing your own brain. You're processing these memories. We're doing, you know, I'm sort of guiding you in the room through the work, right? Okay. So is it the same thing that you're taking these psychedelics and... I guess I'm trying to think of it this way. Mm-hmm. So if you're going through the process with, like, say, a therapist, right, it would be the goal would be for it to be a positive experience, some mastery experience, some resourcing, something that actually helps you deal with this trauma. But if you're just out there taking it without that, like, why are good things happening to your brain? Couldn't there also be bad things happening as a result of these trips?
Yes, okay. There could be. And not just from the aspect of quality control of the drugs. But if we say that this makes the brain more neuroplastic and we say it loosens things up, well, if you go out and have some other experience, which is negative, maybe that can create other negative pathways.
You could further traumatize yourself if you
go out. Very possibly.
Okay, that's really important, I think.
So that's where we certainly don't want to encourage that. And at this point, we want to say, well, these should be done in the presence of a therapist. And if you have this neuroplasticity going on that the drugs are encouraging, and then you have a therapy session going on that's going to maybe facilitate you seeing new things, then that is a great way to create new pathways that are productive. You know, so instead of, you know, you can imagine in a therapy session, if a person is always reminded of some traumatic memory, and then they avoid something else in their life, now, if they have the latitude to be able to think of that thing that they're avoiding, then that's something that you can work on. And so the idea is that the psychedelic drug is allowing you to work on that thing that maybe you wouldn't have gotten to with traditional therapy either for a very, very long time or ever. Right. So that's, again, that's another potential benefit.
So, of course, my brain's just like going to different places, but I'm thinking, okay, so if therapists are doing this, and there are therapists who are doing it, it seems to me really important that you are trained in knowing what to expect, how to sort of, you know, to lead people through these experiences.
Yes.
Forget about liability. That's a whole different conversation, mm-hmm. which I think is significant for us, especially if, you know, like we were talking, if the psychiatrist prescribes the drug, but then we're there with them. you know, therapists are, you know, widely vary in their abilities and different skill sets. So to me, it would almost be like a specialty. You would need to have some further, it seems to me, can you talk about that? Like what that would look like?
Yes. What that would look like, and I'm only speaking from the aspect of just the way that drugs and therapies have been rolled out before, it would be, okay, here is all this research. Let's say that there is some area of legality that happens with these drugs. Then we as therapists, along with our colleagues, the psychiatrists, would get the appropriate training, and they would say to us, well, this is the type of session that you should be running. This is the format that you should be doing. This is the protocol. And then we would have the ability to, first probably get supervision under somebody who had done that before,
right,
and then be able to do this ourselves. But it's a very controlled process. And this is very different than saying, hey, let's just make all these drugs legal and go do what you're going to do with them.
Right.
Our standard has to be, do the benefits outweigh the risks? And how are we going to roll out those benefits to their maximal potential and minimize the risks at the same time? That's the standard that we have to look at.
That seems really important. And I think it's important for people to understand that we're not talking about, oh, I'm just going to get super high at my therapist's office, right? I mean, this is, you know, how much of these drugs in these small quantities, are they even experiencing that sort of elated, you know, feeling or whatever, right? I mean, what does that look like?
Yeah, that's the thing that isn't spoken about so much. It may not be a fun experience.
That's really good to point out.
Just like therapy is sometimes not a fun experience.
It's growing pains.
Yeah, absolutely. And so while the different psychedelics are, you know, correlated with this one is more fun, this one is more introspective, this is not about going on a trip for fun. This is about, and to bring it back to trauma and PTSD, this is about helping folks out with this. And
that's extremely difficult issues in their lives.
Yes. You know, and I've seen the war veteran, you know, come in and talk about horrible things, and this would be things that they would have to do and things that they would have to do, you know, under psychedelic drugs. But there's nothing about that is fun.
Right.
So that's not what that's a peripheral discussion to this. So that's the standard that we have to adopt in looking at this and saying, does this make sense?
Yeah. What are the addiction rates associated with these types of drugs? I mean, you know, let's say someone's worried about, I never really did any drugs and now I did this. What do we know about addiction with these types of, this class of drugs?
Low.
Very low. Why is that?
Why it is interesting. It's a strange thing. There was somebody had written about psychedelic experience and said it was like going to Paris, and it was great and it was meaningful and I'm glad I took the trip, but I don't really want to go back. I don't want to be in Paris all the time. And sorry to the Parisians, but
I do. That's, I want to be in Paris all the time.
Maybe it is addictive,
not on drugs.
But yes, but that is emblematic of people talking about their experiences with psychedelic drugs. It's addiction is just not something that comes out.
Why? So what is happening with the brain? What's happening that situation is not so, you know, it's not lighting up the areas of addiction, obviously, in the same way. I'm guessing. Like, what's?
I think it's that it doesn't light up the pleasure centers, first of all, and in not lighting up the pleasure centers, it doesn't create a need. Like, I want more of that. It kind of makes sense in terms of the idea that if this is making the brain more plastic and maybe making some changes, that's not the same thing as, you know, jelly donut, you know, and, oh, I want another. I don't even like jelly donuts. But the idea of there's a known entity here and that feels good, so now I want that again. This is more like that analogy of a trip. And something that somebody's done that has meaning rather than simply pleasure.
Okay. Can we go through a few of the studies that have been done around using psychedelics and what they found?
Yes. And so I have, and I have a couple of headlines. So I believe the gentleman who started AA actually talked about the power of using LSD to treat alcoholism. And by the way, I would like to say this, if it sounds preposterous to anybody else that, hey, guess what? You have serious psychopathology, so you should go do illegal drugs. It sounds that way to me too. But okay, when we see headlines that say, and bottom lines that say, LSD or psilocybin for treating alcoholism, 83% of participants no longer met the criteria for having an alcohol use disorder. And 28% reported that the psychedelic experience was the reason why they decided to change their lifestyle. That's really powerful because alcoholics relapse a lot.
Right.
So if you can do something and they can, 83% of them quit, that's really, really powerful.
That's amazing.
So that's one. There's one that says MDMA can help alleviate PTSD even after just taking it once or twice. So, and this was in a 2018 study, 100% of participants showed reduced symptoms of PTSD 1 year after the trial. Now, you can say maybe they have reduced symptoms because a year went by, but 100% is that's a high mark. That's about as good as you can get. But 67% lost their PTSD diagnosis altogether.
Wow.
So that's a profound, profound finding. So, and the MDMA for PTSD is really, that's really the one that's out in the forefront, of, research and excitement about these drugs. And it's not the least of which, of a reason is because of the veterans and why so many of them are committing suicide. So with all of these headlines that are coming out, the person reading this is going to say, so you're telling me this works for everything? And there is, I think one of the main things that I would want to drive home in this is that if there's too much exuberance about this and there's too much excitement, that can just, maybe that'll underlie making a lot of this stuff legal, not rolling it out in a way that can help the most people, because that's the bigger concern here is not that everybody should be going on trips, but that if there's a way that you can help people with this class of drugs, that we should be doing it. So there are big claims and exciting studies. And obviously we know from reading the news and, you know, we've talked about with research that the news wants to say, what is the most extreme finding possible. Let's state it in the most extreme way as somebody who is a newspaper reporter and maybe not a scientist. Right. So a lot of this is getting filtered through that, and it's happening so fast.
Right. Exactly. So if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the use of psychedelic drugs to treat trauma and other mental health issues like depression and anxiety and PTSD. And so what we were just talking about, the research, what other research is still needed, would you say?
Well, beyond, there's a certain research protocol in different phases of drug treatment that we have in the United States. The research that I think that I would say is needed is, look, if we know that these psychedelic drugs, particularly administered in microdose form, they're not that dangerous, you would tend to want to try them out with different diagnoses. And what the thing that I am wanting to create is sort of a grid of, here is the psychological diagnosis on one axis. Here is the psychedelic drug. Let's see where those fit in, you know, whether it's mushrooms for anxiety, MDMA for PTSD. Let's see how strong those effects are in each of those boxes. And then where there's an empty box, maybe if it seems like a good idea, let's say that perhaps we should take a look at that and do research on that. So the research that's being done, a lot of the research is being done in overseas, in Europe, and the politics of this, which I think is something that, you know, you have to talk about a little bit. There's a different political landscape in Europe than there is in the US. And there are countries that have different levels of legality of these drugs. And that is going to directly underlie the kind of research that can be done and who can do it. So I think that the research that's going on in Europe, I mean, they at Imperial College in London, they have established the first psychedelic research consortium. So it's a formal part of that school. Mm-hmm. So the research that has to be done is looking at the breadth of the drugs and the possibilities on helping folks with different diagnoses. I think one thing that in researching for this that I think is very interesting is if neuroplasticity is the reason and the encouragement of neuroplasticity is the reason that these drugs might work, I think that the possibilities for something like autism, which is a very, very widespread diagnosis, I think that has some very exciting possibilities. And to see how some of these drugs might really work with autism. And they're doing this already.
I saw that with social anxiety.
Yes.
Yes. Amazing.
Absolutely. And and you know, there are oddball kind of sounding studies where I don't even know if it's a study or just an article where women in the UK are saying, hey, I'm taking mushrooms and it's helping me be less bored playing with my kids. So there's just so much that's going into this.
Yeah. I saw one study. It's actually the study on sexual trauma, but it said that it helped people be more open to experience. Yes. If you think about trauma and especially sexual trauma, right, you're going to be shutting down.
Absolutely.
So I could see maybe openness to your child's play. Maybe that would be a good thing. Yeah,
absolutely. Right, absolutely. Right. And you know, the hope is that that doesn't underlie and take away from the really important help that this could provide to those folks with trauma and treatment resistant depression and severe anxiety. Because if people want to go on a trip or they want to have more fun
they can
playing
do
with
that.
Toddlers, that's all fine as long as that doesn't take away from the possibilities that might come with these drugs.
Yes, because people are truly suffering and there is a limit to what we can do, right? Especially because of the damage to the brain. As I'm sitting here, I'm also thinking, gosh, you know, I can just sort of fast forward this about 20 years and see like big pharma like taking this over and screwing it all up. So how do let's talk about that.
So, and this, I was thinking about, even in preparing for this show, which I've done over a long time period and carefully, we just had a decriminalization of mushrooms in Denver. Some kind of shaky legislation. And apparently 11 people were charged.
That was just recently, right?
Yes, that was like 10 days ago.
Okay.
Apparently there were only 11 sort of arrests where mushrooms were even involved there, but there was the big fight for, you know, decriminalization and it was some.
So they're laying the groundwork though for, is that what's happening? Is that why this legislation might be happening? That would make sense.
And your question, and you're thinking about how this might roll out, is really interesting to consider too, because the only one of these that is a plant is the mushrooms. So decriminalization of mushrooms, and the fact that it's already happened, that might be the way that that rolls out in sort of a marijuana legalization paradigm. These other drugs, though, big pharma would want to participate in them, but all of these are off patent. You know, LSD, that was synthesized in 1943, MDMA, also way too old. DMT, ayahuasca, that's coming out of plants in the forest. These are things that because they're off patent, it's hard for big pharma to make a lot of money because everybody can make a generic version. That being said, they still could make some money. It might undercut some of the business that they have with traditional psychopharmacological interventions, because if you're the drug company and you're wanting to sell the new SSRI, you know, the new Prozac that comes out for a whole lot of money, and somebody says, well, I'll have these mushrooms instead.
Just take them for a little while, not forever.
Yes.
Right.
That's something that big pharma is going to
fight back.
They're going to push against.
Of course. Right.
So
Okay. In our last few minutes, we've been talking about psychedelics and the use of treating trauma and depression and other things. Let's just go over one more time because I think people might hear this and that are the average user. And I just really want to hit home. We're talking about clinical use, how we're going to use it, when we use it. Can we just one more time highlight in a nutshell what we're talking about with this concept tonight?
Yes, absolutely. So we're talking about a lot of illegal drugs, but we are not encouraging their use. And we're not encouraging their recreational use. What we're addressing is, do these drugs have clinical possibilities? Why might they have clinical possibilities? And what are their possibilities? And so there's a lot of research being done. The research is going at a blistering fast pace. The legality and decriminalization is also, and at least internationally, is going at a blistering fast pace. And so it makes all the sense in the world that we're here in your studio in Laguna Beach, which is a liberal sort of city inside of a conservative enclave of Orange County, in a more liberal state of California, in a more conservative nation.
I like how you put that. That was really good.
So it really makes sense. And it speaks to the different feelings that people have about these drugs is going to be the thing that makes it whether or not they become legal and how that is rolled out. And it's not something that is necessarily conservative folks believe one thing and liberal folks believe another, because people have had experiences where they know veterans or something like, you know, temperance that has liberal origins. So it's not a simple question of who's for it and who isn't. And it's really going to be a discussion that's, I think, going to be pushed to the forefront in society about what we want to do about the possibilities clinically and otherwise with these drugs.
Well said. I think that's incredibly important. That's the bottom line, right? We're trying to help people. And we, you know, as time goes by, we learn and we grow and we hopefully open to new things. And so I think this is definitely the root of something that's going to be much bigger. And I think it's important to say it is not a for or against. If you know somebody suffering with PTSD or, you know, treatment-resistant depression, it's life or death. It really can be, you know? And so I think it's important to broaden our minds and expose ourselves and our communities about what our options are and you know, where we can go with it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess that's it. Anything else we need to talk about in the last couple of minutes that you think it's important to share on this topic of psychedelics and the use of treating trauma?
I think the thing to share is to tell people that no matter what notions you have about these drugs, make sure that you inform yourself. And that is important for you as an individual. And whatever you find as a result of your research, let your voice be heard and let your vote be heard on that.
And where can a person go if they want to learn more about these issues? Where, I mean, I saw actually the APA, the American Psychological Association, had a couple articles on it, on MDMA and on using mushrooms. It's really everywhere, but is there a site? I found a few sites actually that I stumbled upon, but I wasn't sure what quality they were. Can you make any recommendations or anything like that?
Where can't you go at this point? It's such good copy for news folks. I think that what I would tell people, rather than suggesting a resource, I would say if you read something about psychedelics and you read an article, whether it's the New York Times or it's one of any major New York any major news organization, make sure that you look for the references in there and read the research that underlies those exciting headlines. Because you may have to slog through some stuff that's not that exciting, but that will show you how they did what they did and why they found what they found. And I think that's the thing that underlies whether you're informed about this.
So what should they be looking for specifically? What are just a couple of things they should be really looking for?
Well, if an article makes an exciting claim about, 100% of people were helped by this, look at who they recruited. Was it the most severe cases? Did they recruit people who were very motivated to do better and were on their way?
What's the population? Who are they treating?
Okay. What's the population and what did they do with that population? Okay. And what was the finding that happened? Because that's the way to really truly understand the research finding. This stuff is more important than just being a headline. It is, it is more important to study it as something beyond that because of how much it could possibly help people.
Okay, thank you. And just a last question. What specifically about this topic did you want to learn more about? Why did it pique your interest? I mean, outside from helping people, obviously, and all that.
Yes.
Did you just know people? Did you read about articles? I mean, how did you kind of stumble upon it, I guess?
I started reading articles and I started watching some lectures about it. And it struck me the way it probably strikes so many people. That sounds absolutely preposterous.
Right.
And so it was kind of like, well, does this have any sort of validity? Is this real? So I kind of went down that road and it got more and more popular over the years.
Right.
And now we all owe it to ourselves to understand it better.
I agree. And I'm grateful that you did discover this topic because we talked about it quite a while ago. And, you know, we agreed it was a delicate topic, but I think a really important one. And you did such a great job with Grace explaining everything. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Sage.
Of course. You've been listening to the Dr. Kim Sage Show. This show airs live every Monday evening at 8 p.m. And my guest tonight was Dr. Edward Marginis. He is a psychologist in Newport Beach. Can you tell our guests where they can reach you if they want more information? Because you also, in your day job, treat children, teens, young adults with academic issues, ADHD, depression, anxiety, those types of things. Where can our guests find you if they want to find you?
I am in the Psychology Today directory. You can email me at Marginis, PhD, M-A-R-G-I-N-E-S, PhD, at Gmail. And I'm not going to give my phone number out over the air.
So. All right, great. Well, thanks again for listening to our show. As I said, the Dr. Kim Sage Show airs live every Monday evening at 8 p.m. And we just really explore all things therapy related, including really focusing now on chronic stress and life's big and little traumas. So I hope everyone has a wonderful evening and I will see you guys next week.